You're listening to Policy Currents, a weekly podcast from RAND. I'm Evan Banks.
And I'm Deanna Lee. Every Friday, we bring you new insights from RAND's latest research and commentary. It's July 26th.
Last Friday, a global computer system disruption brought flights, banks, trains, and businesses all around the world to a halt. The outage was traced to a single update of Falcon, a software product offered by the cybersecurity firm CrowdStrike. The fact that a domino effect like this produced a global disaster serves as a stark warning of the risks posed by today's interconnectivity, says RAND's Jonathan Wellburn. A special set of firms, CrowdStrike and Microsoft, for example, have systemic importance to a wide range of critical functions. And when they go down, so does everything they touch. Experts call these big, interconnected, and hard-to-replace firms systemically important entities, or SIEs. One key step the United States can take to strengthen its defense against future meltdowns is to establish and codify a list of SIEs. Wellburn co-authored a RAND report that outlines a transparent, data-driven methodology for how to do just that. The report highlights how the government might determine systemic importance by measuring a company's size, role in global supply chains, and market share. Also key to this effort will be tools like stress tests, which policymakers can use to identify potential sources of failure, plan for disruption, and ensure that any regulation they put in place doesn't distort the market. The world has changed since the 2008 financial crisis, Wellburn says. It's not just banks that are too big to fail. And while identifying other entities that could spur a global disruption may not prevent the next crisis from happening, it will help society plan for the impacts.
The attempted assassination of former President Donald Trump earlier this month raises concerns about possible copycat or retaliatory attacks on public figures, and more broadly, the public. The best way to defend against such attacks is to prevent them, says RAND's John Hollywood. Understanding the warning signs is key, and there are ways that everyone can contribute. What kinds of warning signs should we all be on the lookout for in the weeks and months ahead? Not hostile comments or even idle threats on social media, Hollywood says. Instead, look for, quote, intentions and actions among those in your circle of acquaintances that reveal a commitment to carrying out an attack. This could be those who state that they've been inspired by previous attacks to do the same, or those who write plans for an attack, draft a manifesto justifying an attack, or conduct research on how to kill individuals or maximize casualties. Coordinating with known violent extremists is another warning sign. Logistics indicators are concerning as well. These might include amassing arsenals of weapons and ammunition without a legitimate explanation, like collecting, target shooting, or hunting. Another logistics indicator is traveling to receive paramilitary training or to scope out the site of an attack. If you see any of these warning signs, there are many ways to report them. If you suspect an attack might be imminent, call 911. And to report a potential plot, the most relevant resource may well be school or workplace authorities. The Department of Homeland Security also maintains a directory of state and local tip lines as part of their See Something, Say Something website. And the FBI accepts reports at tips.fbi.gov. If you are seriously concerned about someone, even if uncertain, make the call, Hollywood says. When it comes to protecting the public and public figures, we are our best defense.
China has been increasingly using disinformation to undermine the United States and alter international perceptions of Beijing's claims and behaviors. Even in peacetime, such information operations are dangerous, say RAND's Jeffrey Hornung and Mina Pullman. For example, a rock was thrown at a Japanese children's school in China's Shandong province, and a brick was thrown at the Japanese embassy in Beijing. These anti-Japanese actions are believed to have been motivated, in part, by Chinese government disinformation about the safety of treated wastewater being released into the oceans from the Fukushima nuclear plant. Disinformation campaigns also have the potential for long-term damage, because they can create new, quote-unquote, truths and foster damaging opinions that are more supportive of China and its authoritarian worldview. Consider the fact that Beijing has been conducting narrative warfare against Taiwan for decades, seeking to create the perception that Taiwan is, always has been, and always will be a part of China. These and other active disinformation campaigns out of Beijing work against the interests of the United States and its allies. That's why our experts say the U.S. and Japan should take steps to protect their alliance from this threat. To start, both countries will need to identify the relevant U.S. and Japanese organizational entities that are tasked with monitoring and countering disinformation narratives. The governments could then explore collaboration with social media platforms around the world to counter disinformation. The governments could also work together to develop a common information operation strategy. It will also be essential to build societal resilience to disinformation in both countries. This might include fostering a more diverse media landscape by funding independent public broadcasters, investing in education, especially in building media literacy skills, and supporting local journalism. Taking steps such as these would help democracies push back on China's disinformation campaigns, and potentially withstand Beijing's more extreme disinformation campaigns, which are likely to be employed in a future conflict or crisis.
Survey data show that a growing number of American couples are choosing to sleep separately, a phenomenon that has been termed sleep divorce. But choosing to sleep apart is hardly a divorce, says Rand's Wendy Troxell, a renowned sleep expert. In fact, she says, it's time to rebrand sleep divorce as a sleep alliance. The term sleep alliance suggests a collaborative and couple-centered approach to sleep, rather than a separation or societally prescribed norm. It implies that couples are working together to ensure both partners get the rest they need, fostering a healthier relationship dynamic and prioritizing mutual well-being and health. Troxell has some tips for couples who may be considering this option, perhaps due to differences in sleep preferences, schedules, or disturbances like snoring. Start with open communication about sleep needs and preferences, she says. Discuss these issues openly and without judgment, because understanding each other's sleep challenges is the first step to finding solutions. It's also important to time these discussions optimally, she says. Conversations in the middle of the night or after a sleepless night rarely end well, as lack of sleep compromises emotion regulation, problem-solving, and communication skills. Troxell also encourages couples to try different sleeping arrangements before zeroing in on a permanent strategy. And finally, if sleep issues persist or are severe, consider consulting a sleep specialist who can provide tailored advice and strategies and determine if a sleep disorder in one or both partners is the root cause of the problem.
That's it for this week's episode. If you'd like to learn more about what we discussed today, check out the show notes at rand.org/podcast. We'll see you next week. RAND is a nonprofit institution that helps improve policy and decision-making through research and analysis.